the fourth line on page 74. Now, it's on account of these things, namely the advantages of the weak, that is, seeking to have more than the many, is said by convention that this, namely seeking to have more by the many, is said by convention to be unjust and shameful, and they call it doing injustice. But nature herself, I think, reveals that this very thing is just for the better, to have more than the worse, and the more powerful than the less powerful. Now, Socrates really can't disagree with this, stated at a level of generality, especially in terms of the better and the worse. And when you get to Aristotle's Ethics, where he talks about distributive justice, basically the claim is that those who are better should get more than those who are less better, and that the inequality of distribution should be proportional to the inequality of quality between the people there, because it would be unjust to treat unequal people equally. The basic principle, the better should have more than the worse, is not an indefensible principle. Better athletes have more ribbons than worse athletes, and generally it's in proportion to how good they are. Better golfers win more money than worse golfers, and it's generally proportioned to the differences in quality. And it would be a crazy and unjust system if really spectacular golfers got exactly the same amount of prize money as really mediocre golfers, and in fact that anybody who enters a golf contest gets an equal portion of the prize. That would be mad. Of course, you'd sign me up for golf if that were guaranteed, but everyone would be. I have insomnia problems, and I know that if there's a 24-hour golf channel on cable, that's my cure. And if anyone knows of a 24-hour golf channel, please let me know, and I'll call my cable company. Okay, because that's the only cure that I hold out for my insomnia. So seeking to have more, if you're better, is what's just by nature, he says. And it is clear in many places that these things are so, both among the other animals and in whole cities and races of human beings. The just has been decided thus, for the stronger to rule the weaker and to have more. Indeed, making use of what kind of justice did Xerxes lead his army against Greece or his father against the Scythians? Now, there's a note here that points out that Xerxes lost both times he led his army against Greece, and Darius lost against the Scythians. But the fact of the matter is that I don't think this contradicts his claim, because he's really just saying that the stronger rule, and in this case, the Persians lost because they weren't stronger, in some sense. Or one could tell of myriad other such cases. Indeed, I think these men do these things according to the nature of the just, and yes, by Zeus, according to the law of nature. Now, the by Zeus, I think, is the oath that's referred to. And the sense is that, well, Zeus isn't written into nature. There's no Zeus. That's merely a bit of Greek folklore. And the appeal to the folklore, namely Zeus, in support of justice, is an indication that there's more to justice than just the just by nature. I think that's the assumption of that note. The use of the notion natural law is a kind of metaphor, right? Because the primary sense of law are the enactments of legislatures, which are conventions. But then we talk about nature being governed by laws, and we mean something different than conventions, even though that word law is there, or in the Greek, right. You know, and there's the primary sense that the right was originally just meant right by convention, but then it migrated over to the notion of right by nature, and there was a kind of modulation of the concept. But I do think it's the oath that refers to the conventional dimension, because, and there's a recognition that laws of nature somehow might need appeals to the divine, which the assumption here is that it's conventional. Callicles probably doesn't believe that Zeus is real, but he appeals to Zeus nonetheless. What's that? Well, it might just be a bad habit. A lot of people who are atheists go around saying, "God damn," you know. It could be that, but I wouldn't say that would be a good interpretation of Plato, because everything is more meaningful than just realism in Plato. But the context here is sort of the history of Greek sophists and natural philosophers, and the tendency was for them to think that notions of the divine were purely conventional. So, for instance, Xenophanes said, human beings worship human gods, and if oxes could worship gods, they would look like oxes. Why? Because we worship things that are merely accommodated to our own faculties. They had a heightened awareness of the variations amongst religions because these people traveled a lot. The sophists were itinerants. Herodotus was really not so much a sophist as the father of history, but one of the things that he made the Greeks intensely aware of are the incredible variations in customs. And so he declared that custom is king, right, and that custom varies. And this is true. Custom is king for so many people. What Socrates does in criticizing Callicles is he exploits the lack of clarity that Callicles has about what constitutes superiority. Is it merely a matter of might, or is there something more that makes it, or something different that makes a person superior? Because, properly understood, superiority for Socrates does confer superior rights, but it has to be properly understood. And as it turns out, it has everything to do with wisdom and very little to do with brute strength. Right? So let's go forward. At the center of that page, 74, he talks about how convention gets inside of us by molding the best and most forceful of us, catching them young like lions, subduing them by charms and bewitching them. We reduce them to slavery, saying that one must have an equal share and that this is the noble and the just. But I think if a man having a sufficient nature comes into being, he shakes off and breaks through all these things and gets away, trampling underfoot our writings, spells, charms, and the laws that are all against nature, and the slave rises up to be revealed as our master, and there the justice of nature shines forth. Much as we try and restrain these people by socializing them, some of them are too strong, and they'll burst through these constraints and rise up and become our masters. This is the sort of Nietzschean Übermensch type, right? The emancipated soul, the free spirit. And of course, Callicles sees himself this way, and he's probably right too, because he is relatively emancipated from convention. However, Socrates gets him because of the lack of clarity of his thinking. One of the things that Callicles goes on to do is then he talks about philosophy, and he criticizes it. And it's an interesting thing, because he clearly appreciates philosophy as a component of a liberal education. Right, it's a fine thing. However, he says that it's fine for the young, but when you grow up and go around talking about philosophy still, it's contemptible, it's laughable, it's unmanly. And people who spend their lives philosophizing past youth are the kinds of people that you can crack on the jaw and they can't get revenge. They're the kinds of people that you can treat unjustly in any other kind of way. They're the kinds of people who flee from the marketplace and the public places and whisper together in a corner with a few young men. And he also argues that these sorts of people lack an understanding of human character and convention. Now, this portrait of the philosopher is really very much a portrait of the kind of philosopher Socrates is shown to be in Aristophanes' Clouds. A person who knows nothing of characters in men, a person who's off whispering together in a little thinkery with a few emaciated youths, the kind of person who doesn't understand the way society works and things like that. And this isn't, however, a very good description of the way Socrates actually is in Plato's dialogues, because Socrates is always out in the public places talking. In fact, they're talking in a public place right now. This is set in some public place. And we know it's not the house of Callicles, because they talk about back at the house. Gorgias has been giving a public demonstration of his rhetoric, and Socrates has arrived at the end of the show. So this is a public place. And Socrates is always out in public talking. He's not in some little corner whispering to people. And Socrates is masterful at judging people's characters and accommodating his speeches to the differing characters of the people he speaks to. Well, what he's trying to argue, and this is something that's made explicit in the Apology, is that Socrates' reputation was in many ways formed by Aristophanes. And oftentimes people thought certain things of Socrates that really weren't based so much on what Socrates was seen to be doing, as upon what people sort of saw in this play. And Callicles' opinion of Socrates is an opinion that you would have of most early Greek philosophers, but it really doesn't describe the way Socrates is portrayed in Plato. And so there's a certain indication that Callicles has a narrower conception of philosophy, and that Socrates really isn't as bad as he thinks. However, the fact of the matter is that he's dead right when he says that Socrates is the kind of guy you can do injustice to. However, even that's really not true when you think about it, because it's very clear that Socrates had the skill as a speaker, if he wanted to probably get himself acquitted. And he had the political connections and wherewithal to actually prevent the trial from ever taking place. So he could have even wriggled out of the things that Callicles prophetically threatens will happen, that people could put him on trial and put him to death and he would be defenseless. Well, as it turned out, he was put on trial and put to death, but he wasn't the kind of nebbish who was defenseless against these things, which is what poor Callicles thinks philosophers are like, which is these nebbish types, bookish, apolitical, lacking knowledge of human character, incapable of persuading. Most of them are, but not Socrates. He's a more worldly type. There was a huge genre of Socratic discourses that sprung up, and Nietzsche talks about this, how what an amazing cultural transformation Socrates effected through his trial and death. Suddenly, all these Athenians who used to want to conquer the world and become tyrants were running around studying philosophy. And Athens became famous for philosophy and really nothing else after this time. Athens was irremediably in decline at the time poor Socrates had died. And, Greece never really has recovered. Well, here, let me just read from my next class announcement. The dominant impression of philosophy today is, I'm sure I'll discover six misspellings when I do this, is that it is a dry, dull academic subject that is utterly unrelated to life, including the lives of the people who teach it. The dominant impression of philosophers today is that they are drab, dysfunctional, and otherwise unemployable college professors. Academic philosophy may deserve this reputation, but philosophy herself does not. Okay, and I mean, that's always been the case. Most people who go into philosophy are drab, dysfunctional, and otherwise unemployable. And it's a bad rap, but philosophy doesn't deserve the bad reputation that just justly rests upon its epigony, its small followers, right? Mere philosophy professors. It is kind of odd and funny that no literary critic calls himself a novelist just because they read lots of novels and write about them. But people who just read lots of philosophy and write about it call themselves philosophers. It is kind of amusing. You don't have to be a professional or a theorist. You just have to dedicate your life to the pursuit of wisdom. But there are lots of people who teach philosophy in schools and are totally conventional in the way, in fact, aggressively conventional in the way they live their lives. They kind of one-up one another, as a matter of fact, to see who can be the most boring, conventional, blokish type, who can treat it more like being a plumber than their neighbor down the hall, their colleagues. So they're just aggressively ordinary and drab people. Callicles doesn't understand what philosophy can be, and he has a very sort of skewed understanding of philosophy that he just imposes upon Socrates. Socrates is a different kind of bird. Okay, we just have to keep that in mind. And Socrates, after Callicles makes this pretty long speech, as sophists are wont to do, and notice that he doesn't stop Callicles like he stops Polus and Gorgias. He listens. That's an interesting fact. He's willing to listen to Callicles. He's willing to listen to whoever Callicles is, this kind of guy. Why? Because there's something worth listening to. I mean, this is a little deed in the dialogue that's indicative of how Socrates would think about someone like Callicles. Worth listening to. He doesn't cut him off and say, Callicles, I'm going to leave unless you confine yourself to short answers. He doesn't do that. He does that with Polus. But Callicles is worth listening to, and we should take Socrates' deeds seriously and listen to him too. I really think that he wants to hear what Callicles has to say, because I think he doesn't feel like it's going to be just a stream of cliché. But on the center of 77, Socrates' response is this: if I happen to have a golden soul, Callicles, Would you not think I'd be pleased to find one of those stones, a touchstone, with which they test gold, the best such stone, so that when I had applied the soul to it, if that stone agreed with me that the soul had been finally taken care of, I would at last be on the point of knowing well that I am in sufficiently good condition and have no further need for another touchstone. He's saying, look, and this is wonderful, he's saying, look, if you want to know yourself, you have to find another person who you can test yourself against, who's the right kind of person. If you want to know if your soul is gold or some baser stuff, you have to find a touchstone. And a touchstone is, you know, jewelers literally rub gold against it, and it allows them, because they've studied this carefully, to judge if it's 24 carat or 14 carat or however basely alloyed it is. And so what Socrates is saying is, Callicles, you're my touchstone. If I rub my soul against you and it comes up gold, I know that's an accurate reading of my soul. And that's very high praise. That's very high praise. And I don't think he's just being pompous. He says he's a godsend. I don't think he's being sarcastic. Yeah, he had to be fictional. He couldn't find any real opponents who were worthy of him. And then he goes on and he talks about the characteristics that Callicles has that makes him so useful, the second to the last line on 77. They have to have knowledge, goodwill, and outspokenness. And he continues, "For I fall in with many who are not able to test me on account of not being wise as you are. And others are wise, but they are not willing to tell me the truth on account of not caring for me as you do. And these two foreigners here, Gorgias and Polus, are wise and friends of mine, but are rather too lacking in outspokenness and too sensitive to shame, more so than is needful." And I think that's very interesting. He's saying on the one hand that being sensitive to shame is a needful thing, but you can be too sensitive. A good gentleman, a decent ordinary bloke, should have an acute sense of shame. But if you have too acute a sense of shame, that's going to hamstring you in the pursuit of wisdom. Why? Because, again, there's a sense in which people who are gentlemanly and have a sense of shame are people who respond the currency of conventions, right? But sometimes conventions are false or nutty or silly or lack importance. And a person who is not willing to test convention and think outside of convention is a person who's not really capable of philosophizing. So Gorgias and Polus, they have too much shame, whereas Callicles doesn't have any, apparently. However, Socrates does make it clear here that you can have too much shame more than is necessary, but that does recognize that some is necessary. And why is some necessary? Well, if you have no sense of shame, you are a sociopath, right? A person with no sense of shame is a person who's entirely immune from the good, not just immune to the fine, which is deeply infused with conventions that one might have to get oneself emancipated from, but also a person with no shame is entirely dead to the appeal of the good, which might have more ultimate worth than merely conventional notions of what's fine. Okay? And so the soul has to be open to what's good. And as it turns out, Callicles thinks he's pretty darn shameless, entirely shameless, but he's not. And one of the things that's important here, and I'll point this out quickly, is the reference to this concept of pathos on page 71, about 2, 4, 6 lines down. Socrates says, "Callicles, if human beings did not have some pathos, some feeling that was the same, some having one and others another, but if some one of us suffered some private feeling different from what the others feel, it would not be too easy to point out one's own affection in the other." He's saying, look, unless we have common feelings, we can't understand one another's feelings, right? If you say, "I feel depressed," and I say, "Well, I just don't know what that means." You know, I'm reminded of the early television interview with Prince Charles after he proposed. And some interviewer said, "And you're very much in love." And Diana bubbles, bats her eyes, "Oh, yes." And he says, "Whatever that means." What does it mean? If you've not experienced it and somebody says, "I'm in love," what does it mean? One of the things, though, that happens is the assumption is that Callicles does have a capacity for pathos, passion. It's a thing you undergo, a thing you suffer. And that is something that you can have stirred in the direction of the good. And so, you know, Callicles is a person who is not entirely deaf to the appeal of the good, although he doesn't seem to have any conventional shame. Although when it comes right down to it, he has a lot of very conventional notions that Socrates is emancipated of. Another thing that's really wonderful is, and I'll just point this out, we can't really read it, is on page 72. Well, it's really from 71 to 72 when Socrates talks about how the two of them are lovers and not of one another. And basically, Socrates' primary love is with philosophy. And philosophy always says the same thing to Socrates. And Socrates lives his life in accordance with what philosophy says. And because philosophy is unchanging, Socrates, by following it, is always in harmony with it and always in harmony with himself, even though he's in disharmony with the vast majority of people. Whereas Callicles, the sophist, the popular rhetor, the guy who's trying to get to the top in the political realm, is always trying to be in harmony with what other people say, the people. Because, of course, to lead the people, you have to follow them, which is the great irony of the person who pursues power, right? To lead the people, you have to follow them. You know how that works, right? You take these polls for the movie industry. They're trying to lead the public. How do they lead the public? They find out what the public wants and follow it. And they adjust the movies and clip things and change their trailers and things like that based on market research. To lead the people through the theater, they have to follow what the people really want. Same in politics. And Socrates puts it this way. He says, Callicles, you're always trying to be in harmony with the ever-changing opinions of the masses, which puts you out of harmony with yourself. And that's really the choice. Do you pursue internal integrity, harmony with yourself, at all costs, in which case you have to have the courage to be out of touch and out of harmony, out of tune with the people around you? Or do you pursue harmony with others at the cost of always being out of harmony with yourself? Okay, because there's a conflict there. And it's only in the rarest of situations where the conventions and the opinions of the people around you would be in total harmony with what you need for yourself to be a well-formed and healthy individual. And since that's hardly ever going to be the case, and if it is, it'll only be for 10 seconds, right? And then it's different, because that's the way public opinion is. It always changes. If you're going to be a slave to public opinion and harmonize yourself with it, you'll always be out of harmony with yourself. And this is what's slavish about the people who pursue power in the public realm. They're slaves because they have to be panderers to the ever-changing opinions of others, and they can't be true to themselves. Whereas the person who's not pandering to others but caring for their own soul has to deal with the fact that they're going to be out of tune. Okay, and he just poses this as an absolutely stark choice, but it's a choice that's absolutely true. You know, I think it's magnificent the way it's put. And the language of harmony and discord is beautifully used there. Now, let me just quickly run through the critiques that Socrates runs against Callicles. Basically, he says, Callicles, you say that justice that's purely conventional is what's instituted by the many to their own advantage. And who are the many? The weak, the low, the people that aren't really worthy of too much respect. Conventional justice is the advantage of the weaker. What is natural justice? It's what's to the advantage of the stronger by nature. But who is the stronger, the one or the many? Well, the many. Therefore, he says, isn't it the case, Callicles, that by your own standards, what's just by nature is the law of the many, because the many are stronger than the few? Callicles is just appalled by this, because of course that's not what he means. You know, he doesn't mean that any rabble of slaves and lowly men who gets together and enacts something is right by nature, just because they have mere might. Okay, so he's forced to immediately abandon this equation of right and might, because as soon as you recognize that it's the many who are mighty and the few who are not, then the person who believes that might makes right has to be a Democrat. He's not a Democrat. He's an elitist. And so therefore, he has to reformulate his sense of what makes a person superior. It's not strength, because the inferior, banded together, are strong. What is the superiority of the genuinely superior? Socrates suggests, well, do you mean that the superior man is, the term is phronimos, which means the prudent or wise individual? And he says, yes, I mean the prudent or wise individual, and the prudent or wise individual should get more than the imprudent. And then Socrates brings out his craft analogies and deploys them maddeningly. Poor Callicles is just driven to distraction by all these stupid craft analogies, because the last thing he wants to talk about are hide tanners and doctors and shoemakers and things like that. But Socrates brings him out and he just flogs him with this. And he's saying, Callicles, are you saying that if you go to the hospital where the doctor is the wisest man, that because he's the wisest man, he gets to take most of the pills? Are you saying that? The doctor gets more of the pills because he's wiser. The doctor gets more surgeries because he's wiser. Is that what you're saying? Of course not. Of course not. If it's wisdom that gives a person the right to rule, then wouldn't the portion that they allot themselves be the wise portion? Whatever that is, whether it's bigger or smaller than the wise portion allotted to someone else. If wisdom gives you the right to rule, wouldn't you want not more than others, but what's wisest, which might be less than what others get? If you're the doctor and you prescribe the medicine, the wisest dose of Valium might be no dose at all for you. However, if you're treating someone who's nervous, the wisest dose might be to give them more Valium than you take yourself. The wise course is to have a leg amputated. If he's getting one leg amputated, I want two, damn it. Okay, that's madness. And of course, this kind of argument is calculated to drive poor Callicles to distraction. And he says, no, Socrates, you're always going on. This is the top of 83, second line. By the gods, you simply always talk without stopping about cobblers and clothiers and cooks and doctors, as if our speech were about these people. So Socrates says, well, who are we talking about then? And he says, I'm talking about politicians, damn it. I'm talking about the people who are wise and prudent in public matters and also courageous. These are the ones who should have more. The people who rule should have more. The people who have power, the people who have freedom, should have more. And Socrates then raises a wonderful question. It's just devastating, and at this point we can sort of, we'll be done. He's saying, bottom of page 83, above where it says 491D, it's about, I guess, a third of the way from the bottom of the page. Callicles says, but indeed, I have already said, those who are intelligent in regard to the affairs of the city and courageous, these are the ones. He says, for it is fitting that these men rule the cities, and the just is this, that these, the rulers, have more than the others, the ruled. But what in relation to themselves, comrade? What in the world? Rulers are ruled. What do you mean? I mean that each one himself rules himself. Or is there no need of this, that he rule himself, but only that he rule the others? What do you mean, ruling himself? Nothing complicated, but just what the many mean, being moderate and in control of oneself, ruling the pleasures and desires that are in oneself. What a pleasant fellow you are. You're saying that the moderate are the foolish. These people are stupid if they're moderate. How so? There's nobody who would not understand that this is not what I'm saying. Yes, it most certainly is, Socrates, since how would a human being become happy, here we get it, happiness, while being a slave to anyone at all, including himself, he's saying. No, this is the fine and just according to nature, which I am now telling you outspokenly. The man who will live correctly must let his own desires be as great as possible and not chasten them. And he must be sufficient to serve them when they are as great as possible through courage and intelligence, and to fill them up with things for which desire arises on each occasion. You know, this is how you live well, to have huge appetites and to gobble down everything that your appetites desire. This is the good life. And that means not ruling yourself, but serving yourself, serving your appetites, not ruling them. If you have to discipline yourself, you're no better than a slave. And so this is a fundamental and marvelous question about politics, right? Is a person qualified to rule others if he cannot even rule himself? If you find a politician who eats 12 hamburgers at a time, is constantly chasing skirts, right? And is conspicuously incapable of ruling. This is a hypothetical politician. And is incapable of ruling his... No, not necessarily. Incapable of ruling his own appetites. The question is this person capable of ruling others? If you can't rule yourself, are you qualified to rule over others? That's the question Socrates is raising. Callicles is saying, if you rule over yourself, you're no better than a slave. If you rule your appetites, you're no better than a slave. The good life is a life of self-indulgence, of getting as much as you can, and going back for seconds. You bite off as much as, and even more than you can chew. That's the good life. Socrates is saying, no. The good life is a life of self-rule. And if you don't have a person who can rule himself, how in the world can he be qualified to rule over others? And so Callicles is just a wonderful advocate of hedonism. And we're going to look at more Callicles in my class on the pursuit of happiness when we talk about the pursuit of pleasure, because he's a great advocate for this position. But anyway, this really sort of ends the topics for tonight, and then we'll continue, and what we get after this is Socrates' critique of hedonism, which is a marvelous set of arguments. But we have to recognize something about this. Socrates is moving Callicles in the direction of recognizing that if he grants his basic principles, if he accepts them, and Socrates does accept many of Callicles' principles, in particular, that the prudent human being has the right to rule. He regards that as unimpeachable. That the best life is going to be the philosophical life, and ultimately not going to be the political life, because that's the life that's most in accordance with ruling and freedom properly understood. Whereas the life of the tyrant, or the demagogue, is not the life of ruling and freedom properly understood, because the most important freedom is going to be freedom from your passions in order to pursue what you really want, which is happiness. And they're different. And the most important kind of power, again, is the power to pursue your own happiness over the contrary impulses of what your passions might lead you to. And that's really going to be attained only by the person who gets out of the whole loop of public life and practices virtue off on their own. And that's the life of the philosopher. So we're going to find Callicles' premises slowly turned and Callicles oriented away from politics towards philosophy. There's so many things about this dialogue that make it seem like just a kind of advanced sketch for the Republic, because this is one of the main themes in the Republic, too, the superiority of the philosophical over the political life. Many of the same arguments that are talked about in the Republic are sketched out here. So it is, in a way, a kind of sketch or trial run for the much bigger book. But anyway, so let's just continue reading, and we'll talk about hedonism next time. The only thing that you should not moderate your desire for is wisdom. There's never such thing as too much wisdom.